At Designer Shoe Warehouse, we believe that shoes are an important part of, well,
everything. From first steps to first dates, from all-nighters to all-time personal bests.
From building pillow forts to building a life.
For all the big and small moments that make up your whole world, DSW is there. And we've got just the shoes. Find a shoe for every you from brands you love at bragworthy prices at your DSW store or DSW.com.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. Elbridge Colby, the author of The Strategy of Denial. This is Imagining the Future and a contest between the coalition led by the United States against the hegemon, China, and China's aggression towards Taiwan and or the Philippines and or the rest of the coalition. There is now a disaster scenario, and the denial defense obliges everyone to react in dire fashion. What is it that can keep the denial defense from failing, or what is a predicate for the coalition after the failure or during the contest in which either side could win or lose? I believe that's what we can now talk about as the binding strategy. I'm very carefully reading von Clausewitz because of you, Bridge. And I find, thanks to your emphasis, von Clausewitz talked a lot about psychology and about the resolve, the morale, the ambition, the passion of the contestants. I believe that's part of the binding strategy. How so? Mm-hmm.
No, I think you put your finger on it, John, right? The issue that Clausewitz, of course, was a master of is that, you know, the strength itself is not the only sort of factor that's relevant here. The question is how much and how avidly are the combatants prepared to dedicate that amount of strength, right? The France under the Bourbons in 1785 or something, the fervor of the French nation was much more modest, right? Whereas 6-7 years later, with the levée en masse and the mass popular support for the revolutionary armies and the defense of the nation and so forth, you know, suddenly France was putting out a whole different type of military strength and ambition and aggressiveness. And so the question here to put on it is, you know, in this much more difficult and challenging and costly military situation, in which either China has already seized Taiwan, or we see that in order to defend Taiwan, or in the future, say, the Philippines, we're going to have to mount a much larger and more aggressive military campaign, not this targeted one that I'm emphasizing as optimal. How are we going to do that? On what basis? Because that requires resolve. It requires us to have that morale. And you know, this is in the sense in which I think Napoleon said that morale is to strength as 3 is to 1 in war, or something like that. I think this is what Napoleon meant. That the willpower to put that power to use and to do so aggressively is the thing that's a question. Now, most people tend to treat that question of resolve passively as like something that's determined by other factors. And what the planning strategy is designed to do is to get us ahead of this problem. And basically, to put a fine point on it, is to force China onto the horns of a dilemma. China can either try to pursue the focused and sequential strategy and, say, attack Taiwan or in the future the Philippines or others. But in so doing, it will have to do things that will catalyze the resolve of the coalition and bring about that greater war effort, or it will accept the status quo. Now, let me give you historical examples to give some color to it. My favorite example is Japan, 1941, 1942. Now, Japan obviously decided to precipitate a war with by far the most powerful opponent that it had to face, not to mention the colonial powers, the United States, but also Britain and the French and the Dutch and so forth. It didn't have to do that, you know, and it didn't have to behave in a way in so doing where it got a reputation for perfidy and barbarism and atrocities and so forth. It didn't have to do that. What if Japan had instead just attacked the European colonial possessions and left the United States alone? Would the American people have supported going into war, or supported to going to war with the degree of the total war approach that ultimately led to the complete destruction and capitulation of Imperial Japan? I don't think so. I think it's an open question. Another example is Fort Sumter. My understanding is that the Army recommended to President Lincoln and the Lincoln administration that they withdraw the federal troops from Fort Sumter. But Lincoln understood, as he did throughout the war, from what I understand, that it was critical that the South fire the first shot. because that would catalyze the resolve of the northern population to support the war effort and put down the rebellion. That's, in fact, what happened when the South opened fire on Fort Sumter. 75,000 Americans volunteered for the Federal Army. And so that's what we want to do with the binding strategy, is basically work with our allies and partners, and not just our closest allies, but to basically create a military posture and a strategic posture in the region, where even if China just wants to go after Taiwan, they say, but I need to take care of that Japan problem also. I'm going to need to take care of that Australia problem. I'm going to need to take care of the Philippines too. And before you know it, they have precipitated that big war that would lead to their defeat. And by seeing that, they'll decide never to start it in the first place.
What is thematic, and how is it part of the binding strategy?
Thumos is a Greek word, and it basically translates as something like spiritedness or passion. But the basic idea, I have a very rationalistic approach on the whole, but I think, as you can see, kind of following Clausewitz and others, I try to grapple with the reality of passion, right? We understand that human beings, especially in war, passion and feeling and emotion and honor and so forth play a very central role. I mean, the American people had, in a sense, an irrationally angry reaction to what Japan did. If you were just looking at a geopolitical context, maybe the American people should have accepted a limited surrender from the Japanese far before August 1945. But we were, or September, we were so angry that it led us to do things that resulted in Japan's total defeat. And in a sense, that's actually what we want to force the Chinese to have to catalyze. Here I'm thinking of aggrieved honor, revenge, the feelings that the British had over the treatment of Belgium in 1914. I think this is what we need to, and not only at the political level, but I think it'll motivate our fighting forces as well. The more they feel that they are acting in response and as in a just cause and that righteous might that FDR talked about, the better off we're going to be in the fight. And by anticipating that outcome, the more likely we are to deter it in the first place.
China right now has a wolf warrior posture towards the world. It would seem to be lending a hand to the coalition's thumos. You say that part of the strategy that the coalition can use is not only rallying the forces, but creating conditions for China to bad act so that thumos is buoyed. How so?
Well, I mean, I think these are some of the things where in a sense, China is already exhibiting elements of the kind of behavior that would trigger that thumos. And the Germans have done it before and others as well. I think part of the reason is that my friend Ed Luttwak has this, great, strategy is fundamentally paradoxical. The thing that makes China a plausible aspirant for regional hegemony and global preeminence is its size and strength and energy and fervor and the talent of its people. But those very things also make it somewhat narcissistic, I think. And I mean, as Americans, I think we also have our share of narcissism. But I mean, there's a degree in which the Chinese are mostly thinking, I think, largely about their own, political system and their own conversation, and they expect to be respected. And they will more and more, as they get more and more rich and powerful, they expect people to defer. But that itself will trigger. And the very fact that they have a reasonable basis for expecting that is also the thing that will trigger people to say, don't tread on me, right? And so that's what we want to play on. And that's what we want, plans on the way the word, that's something we want to take advantage of and force the Chinese to have to trigger if they're going to go down that route.
And the South China Sea, the fortified islands, Scarborough Shoals, which hasn't been built upon but can be, taking a piece of the Philippines. My measure is that we've normalized that, and that doesn't increase thumos. Is that correct?
I think the South China Sea is more where they're playing the game pretty well. I mean, the thing about the South China Sea, though, that I would say is that at the end of the day, these are uninhabited islets. I mean, the very fact, so they're limited in their significance, certainly in terms of getting countries to give up. You're not going to get the Philippines or Vietnam to give up their autonomy because the Chinese have dredged, islets and the Spratlys and so forth and turned them into military facilities. There are military implications, there are political implications, but there's limits of what China can do. I think it's more the sort of humiliating way in which the Chinese have dealt with some of these other countries, the way that they use their yuan diplomacy and Belt and Road, and ultimately the military threat that's going to trigger thumos. I mean, I think the way that they've, for instance, the reaction in India since the clashes in the line of actual control in Ladakh, that led to, banning of a lot of Chinese apps, a lot of Indian nationalism. The thing is that the other thing that the Chinese are dealing with is, yes, China is a national society, but, you know, in many parts of Europe, nationalism is a bad word. But in Asia, nationalism is a good word. It's anti-colonialism. It's people standing up for self-determination. And so the Chinese are going to run up against the nationalism of, say, the Vietnamese, which we've experienced, of the Koreans, of Japan, you know, of Thailand, of India, et cetera, of Indonesia. And so that they're running into their own spiritedness is going to trigger the spiritedness of others in this kind of, you know, don't tread on me phenomenon. I think there's a latent possibility. But the Chinese are so strong and so rich that they have an enormous amount of both inducements and pressure that they can apply on the other side of the ledger.
We've spent our time with Taiwan and the Philippines crossing a body of water, which is challenging to any military force. That is not entirely the risk here. We've talked of Vietnam, but India, right now, there are tens of thousands of troops facing each other in the Himalayas, extremely challenging conditions. But a contest between China and India is not unimaginable since it's happened before. Is that a scenario where China would have an advantage against the coalition because of the remoteness and because it's not the sea?
I think it could. I think, you know, the good thing about India is it's very strong relative to most countries, not necessarily to China, but and it's very resolute. I mean, I think the Indians are very proud and nationalistic, and they, you know, spend a lot on defense in terms of the proportion of their GDP. I think China, you know, I mean, if China could knock India down and out of a coalition in a way that kind of cowed India, that would be an attractive outcome for Beijing. Now, that's going to be really hard and risky. And I think a conflict just in the upper, you know, elevations would probably not be enough to do that. But, you know, I mean, if I were India, I would be worried. I mean, especially if given the Sino-Pakistan relationship, if China could leverage the Pakistan threat and take advantage of Indian vulnerability to really put India in a hard position, that's one of the strategic challenges I think we're going to have to be thinking. And this is where basically my view is we essentially, you know, unalloyedly benefit from a stronger India, given the relative power balances in the subcontinent and so forth and vis-a-vis China. So we want to empower and bolster India as much as possible because this is a serious challenge for them. And they're invariably tightly aligned with us.
I'm speaking with Elbridge Colby. He is the author of the new book, The Strategy of Denial, How American Defense in an Age of Great Power Conflict. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART or go to LifeLock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.
When we started writing our thoughts down on paper, it opened up endless possibilities. Ideas could grow beyond the borders of the mind, and it changed the world. Somewhere along the way, we lost touch with paper, distracted by devices made for every purpose except for thinking and focus. On edge, waiting for the next notification. But what if new technology didn't pull us away from paper, but brought us closer to it? Listen. That's not paper. It's the sound of the new Remarkable Paper Pro, rewriting the future. A paper tablet with a true color ink display, gentle reading light, and unheard of tactility. With digital features for taking notes, thinking, and organizing, without any distractions. Paper is about to change the world again. Get your paper tablet at remarkable.com today.